Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to announce that Cincinnati, Ohio is officially granted the newest expansion club in Major League Soccer. Welcome, FC Cincinnati.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. That was MLS Commissioner Don Garber making the announcement on Tuesday that FC Cincinnati and the soccer fans had been hoping for since the day the team was organized. FC Cincinnati will join the MLS next season. It may seem that the hard part is over, but in many ways, that announcement was just the end of the beginning. Some really hard work starts now. To explore what the team and the city and the fans face at this point, I am joined, hopefully, by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Patrick Brennan, who covers FC Cincinnati and is planned on joining us, but isn't here right now, and Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Chris Wettering, and WVXU's Tana Weingartner, who's been tracking the twists and turns of this story for quite some time. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Chris, Tana, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a big step, but it's a big step that has some real implications. And Don Garber, who we heard right at the beginning, he also had this other comment that, Tana, you had in one of your stories this week. I want to listen to that and then play off of it.
They're ready. I mean, they're MLS ready now. I mean, their crowds are MLS ready today. You know, they're going to have a lot of work to do on the field to figure out how they go from salary budgets that are dramatically less in the current league than they will be going forward. And but we've seen it before. We had Minnesota come up in less than a year's time.
Well, there we go. I mean, there's a lot to be done on the field. So I guess, Tana, the real question here is, what are the implications for the club? I mean, one thing he's referencing is the total salary, the total budget that the club spends. But that means personnel, coaching staff.
Could we be talking a bigger front office?
A bigger front office?
Yes. A lot more coaching will come on board, I would imagine. And there's going to be a lot of player turnover because you're looking at players right now that are playing in USL. Some of them have been in MLS before, and now they're playing down. So a lot of player turnover, I'm expecting.
What about coach? Do you think the head coach, do you think they have in place somebody they want it to take them to?
I feel like that's a better question for Pat. Is he on the line with us yet? Yep, I'm getting a wave.
Oh, Patrick. Patrick, are you here?
I'm here.
Oh, wonderful, because I had two people sitting in the
I'll give you my opinion
in this report,
but I bet he's got more insight than I do.
What do you think, Patrick, is going to happen with the coaching staff? Do they have the head coach they want to go to Major League Soccer, and it's just a matter of getting a bigger staff, or are they going to have a big turnover there? Patrick?
Yeah, can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. Well, as far as the coaching staff, yeah, I think they have the head coach. And, he's obviously going to handpick his backroom staff around him. But Alan Koch was someone they took from the Vancouver Whitecaps organization, and that was a real coup for FC Cincinnati when they went and got Alan Koch because he was kind of a head coach in waiting in the Vancouver organization. And I don't think he's done anything but improve his case for this team into next season.
Okay.
Yeah, and that backs up what I would have guessed is that they picked him knowing that that was the plan to go forward, and he's been building players and finding players with that kind of idea in mind and setting up the staff that he wants. That's, you know, when he came in, he had somebody else's players that were picked for him, and now they're kind of starting to look at that way. And then he'll probably spend a lot of this season and off season looking for higher level.
And what about the player personnel, Patrick? Are we going to see a big turnover in who's on the field next season versus who's on the field? Is anybody going to survive?
Oh, yeah, I think so. You know, it's funny. I just wrote about this very subject for Cincinnati.com, and the last teams that have attempted the jump or missed the jump from a lower league or minor league to MLS have, on average, combined to bring with them more than six players from the minor league team into MLS. So I think FC Cincinnati would be foolish to think they could build this thing without. To not build it with some of the players they already have rostered right now would probably cause them to spend more money than they would want to spend as an expansion team. There will be turnover. I think the most players in history that were brought up from the minor leagues with a franchise that became an expansion team in MLS was nine. I don't know if FC Cincinnati has that kind of talent on the team, but you know, four, five, six guys, I could certainly make a very strong argument that there are that sum of MLS quality currently exists on Cincinnati's roster, without a doubt.
Well, one of the things that's happening besides what's going on the field is the question of sort of rebranding the team. And there was some talk of this on Tuesday. Tana, that covers a big area. Part of that, though, is this potential technical name change.
Right. They're already operating under Fußball Club Cincinnati, which would be the German. I hope I'm saying it right enough. My big question is whether, so it's spelled F-U-S-S-B-A-L-L. My big question is, are they going to stick with double S's? Or are they going to go to this German character, the Essets, that a lot of the fans have been using, but is not easily found in your keyboard? So it looks cool, but is it feasible? I don't know. And I think, you know.
Team colors stay the same, right?
That's what they've said. You know, they've always said they're same colors. I think they're probably going to tweak them. I don't know that they're going to be the same blue and orange that they are now. Maybe go to something richer.
Boy, that would ensure that people have to buy new merchandise, wouldn't it?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And I think the Flying Stabby Lion, as my friends like to call it, is probably going away.
Okay, Patrick.
That Stabby Lion.
Flying Stabby Lion.
What about the question of ticket prices? Because one of the great things that, you know, has been the case at Nippert is this is really a family thing that you can do, and it's not that expensive. Is how much are ticket prices going to go up?
Over time, I expect they would climb a noticeable amount, and I think that could start relatively quickly when this team begins playing MLS next season. You know, I think you don't want to give everyone sticker shock. And you also have to keep in mind, you know, they're not playing in a new MLS venue yet. The soccer-specific venue is still a couple years away. So a lot of the fan experience and the offerings for fans are going to remain constant year over year. Now, you will be getting a better product on the field. But in terms of having FC Cincinnati's front office having a rationale to ratchet up ticket prices, that's kind of the thing they would hang their hat on. I really do believe that a lot of the fan experience, the amenities, will remain the same, from this year in USL over next year in MLS. So I think that's something, the real significant jump will come when they move to the new stadium. But for now, I think you'll see negligible increases in terms of the cost.
And that new stadium should come online in the 2021 season. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, that's what we're hearing.
Chris, you want to chime in on this?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how many seats they actually end up putting in there. We asked Birding about this, Jeff Birding, the team's president, on Tuesday. And, you know, he basically said, well, it could be – we could open the doors at way higher than 21,000, which was the initial amount that was kind of floated. You know, you're going to play 2 years in Nippert where the capacity of the entire stadium is 40,000. I wonder if there's enough interest. And he said that he expected their attendance numbers to be what they are now, which is, you know, hovering around 30,000, between 25 and 30,000 a game. And so I'll be interested to see, you know, if you go from Nippert, where you have all of this capacity, to this smaller venue, you know, what are they going to really try to stretch and expand the size of that stadium from the get-go? I think that's an interesting question that hasn't yet to be answered.
You know, one of the things about building that new stadium, the high school stadium has to
It
has to be built first.
So when's the new Stargell Stadium? When's the new high school stadium going to be constructed? Anybody seen timelines on that?
I would think I haven't seen a timeline, but you know they cannot wreck the start. Not they can't you know demolish Stargell Stadium until they have a new Stargell Stadium. So best, I think they better get
you
started.
You think they'd want to get it done before the fall? I would just think that's just my guess because you would want to have a place for them to play in the fall so that you could start construction in the fall. But
right,
but I mean that's.
Patrick, have you heard anything?
I would, yeah. I don't know of a formal timeline, but the assumption I've been kind of working under is that you're not gonna, you know, unless you can find temporary venues and work with Ohio high school athletics officials to move things around and help some of the teams that would be displaced out scheduling wise, which I think is a big ask when you consider the. Dealing with some of the dealings we've had with that organization. You can't displace the teams that play at Stargell this autumn. So I don't know if you can even displace teams that would play there in the spring, but I would think they would let the high school football season play out. And then kind of like they did after the FC Cincinnati did after its inaugural season in 2016, when they spent $2 million renovating Nippert. Wait until the football season's over, then get to work on simultaneously building the new high school venue and tearing down Stargell. I would expect that to happen over winter.
Okay.
I just wasn't thinking that would be enough time to build a stadium, but what do I know about construction?
Well, it's not the big. It's also not the biggest infrastructure work in the world to put up a high school stadium. It's, I mean, comparably speaking, it's a. A lot of these things are shanties compared to, like, the MLS venue that we're talking about.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I was talking about the FC, the new FC Cincinnati Stadium.
I would suggest shanties is probably not the right term after we've just gone through all this negotiation. They're going to get a really nice stadium. Chris, you know, there is an effort out there by Michelle Dillingham, and you've written about it this week, to place a referendum on the ballot, I presume, in November of this year.
It would be November.
To do what? She doesn't want all the tax money that the city has committed or some of the tax money.
Well, what she wants and what she can get are two different things.
Okay.
So that there's a – the way that they pass the ordinances to fund the city's share of the infrastructure and the site preparation costs – they passed an ordinance that would take – so the city – the whole city package is, let's just say, roughly $35 million. About half of that comes from the city's share of the hotel and transit occupancy tax. And the city council was not able to pass that ordinance with an emergency clause attached to it, which would have blocked any effort to put a referendum on the ballot. So – that is the only money that they can go after, that opponents of this stadium can go after. And so they intend to do that. They would love, I think, to put a referendum and let the public vote on the entire project. But the ordinances that did that were passed on emergency, and they also made an appropriation, which is – that's doubly not able to be referendumed.
So we're talking $17
million. Right.
Out of – and – what would happen if that, first off, gets on the ballot? And there's some questions still about whether that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, if voters approved that referendum and took that $17 million away, what happens to the deal?
That's a great question. And the city has not commented on Michelle Dillingham and some of the other opponents and skeptics of the stadium. We're doing a lot of assuming on this show, which is dangerous, but my assumption is they're going to have to swallow it. the Lindners and the Farmers and whatnot. Now, maybe, who knows, maybe there'll be lawsuits, maybe there'll be a big court fight over it. But
so the owners would swallow it, not the city would swallow it, because that's going to flow into our discussion right after the
city
break.
Doesn't have the 17 city doesn't million, have the money. You know, they spent their rainy day fund on the stadium infrastructure. And now they have a $32 million budget deficit in addition to that. So I don't know where the city would get $17 more million.
Well, very interesting, because that sets up exactly where we're going to go after this break. I want to thank Patrick Brennan and Tana Weingartner for joining us this afternoon. Chris, stay right where you are.
Thank you.
On Tuesday, interim city manager Patrick Duhaney reported to city council with answers to a list of questions submitted by the Plush family on May the 14th. The manager's report included information about what the city planned to do to correct the weaknesses exposed by the inability to locate Kyle Plush when he died on April 10th. But Kyle's father, Ron Plush, wants to see timelines for those improvements and has follow-up questions. This week, the manager also released a proposal to close a $32 million general fund budget deficit for next fiscal year. To delve into where the city stands on this process, I am joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Chris Wetterick.
Hello.
WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. And longtime Local 12 news reporter Deborah Dixon, who technically retired yesterday, but I can guarantee has not forgotten a thing. You can join our discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org.
If Deb wants to trade, I'll retire and she can take my place.
Well, we can negotiate that, you know. And one of the things you can learn,
second.
One of the things you learn by coming from TV to radio is you don't have to have a suit on every day. You don't have to dress up.
I knew that.
You knew that. You look relaxed. Okay. Seriously, welcome everybody. Jay, council's bearing down on the June 30th deadline to have a budget, to adopt a budget. What's the current estimate? $32 million? Is that the right number, and what sort of proposals exist to close that gap?
The manager did put the number yesterday at $32.1 million. The previous range was 29 to 34, so we got it narrowed down to 32.1. And basically, he's pulled the rabbit out of the hat again. There will be no layoffs, no closure of swimming pools or rec centers or parks or health clinics, and no furloughs for employees. And basically, that's done with a series of reductions, about $24 million worth of reductions, and $10 million of revenue enhancements is the official term, which is basically they're going to hike some fees on building permits, electrical inspections, and raise parking meter rates.
Well, $32 million is a lot of money. So something's getting cut, right?
There is, they called it department belt tightening, which is totals about $9.4 million. And I think it's interesting too, we talk about the fact that there's no layoffs, but there's also a number of open vacant positions that aren't going to be filled. So city staffing is shrinking. It's just not shrinking by layoffs. It's being reduced by positions that are open or just staying open until eventually they can hopefully fill them.
I thought I saw the city headcount going up though in the budget. Am I wrong about that?
I haven't got that far into it yet. I know I saw the staffing chart, but I didn't. I know one thing, that the sworn strength of the police department does not change, and the number of firefighters stays the same.
Dan, there's all kinds of fun stuff we have to talk about with this budget. I mean, the business community really gets kneecapped in terms of the funding that it has come to expect. I mean, they cut funding completely out for Centrifuge and Cincy Tech, which are two of the incubator technology incubators and over the Rhine. They cut,
which generate new jobs in new areas, which have the potential for a lot of other jobs.
These are small investments in the business community and business organizations that are supposed to eventually yield bigger investments. And other people that are cut are, or other organizations that are cut, are Ready Cincinnati, which is in charge of recruiting businesses to the region, for the entire region. They cut the African American Chamber of Commerce. They cut the much ballyhooed new immigrant center that the city was partnering with on the with the chamber on. So there's just kind of a whole host of cuts, and we see again in this budget the term structurally balanced. But when you look through the budget, they have moved a lot of the spending from the general fund to the capital fund, including things like a $5 million payment that they've been making for 17 years to the Cincinnati Public Schools that now is suddenly deemed a capital expenditure instead of an operating.
And I was going to say, your former student and former council member, Kevin Flynn, right yesterday, as soon as I saw that, and I said, well, you got that right. Yeah. Because he said, I told you so. In January, he predicted that they would move some general fund expenses to the capital budget because it's got a little bit more capacity now because they raised the property tax to pay that debt millage.
Right.
But is the argument there – I mean, there's got to be some argument. We got to have a fig leaf here.
Right.
Is this because that payment to the Cincinnati Public Schools is really in relationship to the Bengals Stadium?
That's what they argue, right? That's the argument. I mean, it's
and we've never thought of that argument.
We've
before.
Never in 18 years of making this payment, it's never been a capital expenditure until now.
But we never needed to find $5 million from somewhere else.
You know, there's a really fun chart for me and other dorks, but in the budget, it shows FY17 and FY18, and we were told during the mayoral campaign, oh gosh, we structurally balanced the budget for the first time ever. Everything is great. But this chart it's literally filled with red ink, and it shows that the city has spent more than it took in revenue in both FY17 and FY18. So I find it really, really hard to believe that there is any structural balance, nor has there been for several years.
So you're talking about a lack of revenue.
Right.
But is it that the spending exceeded budget, or is it that revenue fell below?
So spending exceeded revenue, right? So all the money— right.
That's clear.
That's
yes.
clear, yeah. And so they made transfers in, and they basically took it out of their fund balance, which is basically their savings account, right? And so that has been steadily reduced over the last 2 years. And my story today that will be on CincinnatiBusinessCourier.com will explain some of this.
And there is no money left from the sale of Blue Ash Airport.
No, they spent it on that. They spent it on infrastructure for the FC Cincinnati Stadium.
So that's gone.
That was called a rainy day fund. Now it's gone.
That's been there for decades as a pot that they've been able to go to.
To tap into.
And sell. By the way, just before, and this is related, about an hour ago, I got an email from a man by the name of Hans Bohm, who I do not know. He's in the construction industry, and he says, does the residential rehab tax abatement program have any meaningful effect on all of this? And he points out that over the last 30 years, there's been a lot of abatements given, particularly in Over the Rhine and in Northside, the two where buildings that are now maybe worth $350,000 are being taxed at $10,000.
Here's why it doesn't matter. The city council since 1999 has refused to collect more than $29 million per year for operating from the property tax. So all those abatements we see, they don't have any effect because the city is collecting the same amount of money every year. In fact, they reduced in a year that they knew they would face a budget deficit. They reduced the property tax rate overall in the
city. This is the annual discussion about rollbacks.
Right, rollbacks. And this is the operating side only. They increased the capital side of the property tax. So this is all kind of a shell game and kind of confusing. But
the property tax level has been the same since 2000 or 2001. They always try to collect $28.9 million where the charter says they could collect, I think it's 6.1 mils.
Right. Keep in mind, we're talking about two different things. The amount of money they collect from the property tax and the property tax rate. They change the property tax rate all the time, but they only collect the same amount every year. And they have done that since 1999.
So what does that mean that why don't they raise it? I mean, they could do that with a stroke of the pen, right? They don't have to go.
They
to
don't
the
have
voters.
To go to the voters. The charter approved millage is 6.1 mils. They don't have to do it. It's a political thing.
They don't want to be accused of raising taxes.
But they right. But there's a collection of conservative groups such as the Realtors Association that don't want that property tax rollback done away with, and they live in fear of that, and that's why they do it.
And basically, they see it, the supporters of the rollback see it as an unapproved tax increase, because if the city set the mill consistently at 6.1 mils, each time your property value went up, your taxes automatically go up without you voting to approve it, even though that's what the charter says.
And that's what a lot of people think happens.
And that's how every other levy works. We are the only city, major city in Ohio that does this.
Well, with one slight exception, though, even though property taxes go up on a voted millage, it's kind of rolled back so that the amount collected is the same as when it was first passed. So there's always a slight rollback.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to
Can I get a couple of things before we wrap up on the budget? There's a couple of things that are probably going to be a non-starter. The manager cut more than $500,000 from human services programs. That's not going to fly with council. And he also proposed the booting for unpaid parking tickets. That was rejected last year. And I don't see that that's going to be resurrected this year.
Where are they going to find the money this year? That's what I want to know.
And that'll be it'll be hidden in couch cushions in the furniture at City Hall.
All right. Well, we've got a month to agonize over this. And I want to move on to the Kyle Plush situation. Deborah Dixon, I know that you haven't covered every piece of this, but you've been
– Almost.
Almost. Yes. But you've been around this kind of question your entire career. What's your reaction to where we stand with – this new report out of the manager's office, his response to the questions that Ron Plush has posed several weeks ago. Where do you think we stand on this?
I feel like City Council is looking for someone to blame and will never find it. I think what Mayor Cranley said on Tuesday was what the Plush family wanted to hear when he said, the police failed you, the operators failed you, the system failed you. What he didn't say is, and Jay, you can weigh in this, what he didn't say is city leaders failed you. Because I have reports, and I've reported on this going back to 2015, where there were analysis of that emergency call center about all the dropped calls, about operators not being able to hear, about the low morale, about the system that doesn't seem to do its job. 2015, they took their eyes off the prize. That system could have been a priority, and it wasn't a priority. Jay, what do you think?
I was going to say, Cranley, the mayor was pretty specific. He blamed the call taker for not either turning up her volume or going back and listen to the call. He even said the dispatch was wrong. He thought the fire department should have been dispatched because it was a person trapped in a car. If they were trapped, they would have equipment.
Not trapped, though. The call was a woman stuck in
her
car.
But the idea was that if there was entrapment of some sort, then the fire department would have the equipment.
The jaws of life.
Right, to get that person out. And then also the police officers that, you know, he said, and this is the first time I'd heard this, that there were only five vans in this parking lot. And he thought that it was not too much to ask that they would get out and check the five vans in the parking lot.
I think, and now I've talked to top cops, top street cops, and they feel like if they knew what the cops knew, they probably would have done the same thing. Now, we expect more. We want them to do more, and they will from now on. But remember, they didn't have they didn't know that it was someone in distress. They didn't have Kyle's information that I'm in a gold Honda Odyssey parked. They had everything those officers needed for him to be found and saved, and it didn't get to them. Why didn't it get to them? Why didn't they hear it? Why didn't they listen to it? There are so many failures here.
Well, one of the things is the revelation this week that they had GPS location within 5 to 10 feet, not some, but they got an address. The cops were given an address
of the,
not 5 to 10 feet of where the van was.
The whole GPS thing, that's ridiculous. The fire department has the GPS.
And that was another
Why doesn't the police department have it? The smart 911 that Hamilton County Dispatch has, where you register a contact. You have to go online. They started, introduced Smart 911 like 3 days before Kyle died, so it kind of got lost up in everything. But if you go online and register a contact, when they had Kyle's number and he didn't answer when they called him back, a contact would have come up. His father would have come up. Family, his father could have come and found the Honda. Those are things that I believe the city knew about but chose to put on a back burner.
And that was the part of it the mayor was talking about, the fire department, because the fire department does have the computers with the GPS mapping. Too late now, but eventually, sooner rather than later, it's going to be coming to the computer terminals or in the police cars too. So they would have had the same map.
They would have had in their police cruisers the exact location.
But that's probably, to me, the most stunning thing that came out this week, that in fact, like you said, the GPS location was within 5 to 10 feet of where Kyle was found.
Well, you know, as I read this report from the manager, what really strikes me is it comes back to over and over and over again is the SOP, the standard operating procedure. We're going to review the standard operating procedure. There is that. It's not just technology here. It is we're going to train operators to make sure that they turn up the volume on their screen. Some of this, it's like, well, great. It's just I am shocked by how much of this is we have to set up standard operating procedures on everything. Nobody can just sort of think for themselves in these situations.
Or go back and listen. The one operator told her supervisor she couldn't hear the call. It seems like someone, maybe not her, but someone should have listened to it again. But then again, if you've ever been up there, that place is crazy. The number of calls they get, the number of the people who are upset and need help, I think it's an environment that we maybe can't relate to.
And that, you know, the calls, the media were given clearly all that information, you know, about his description, and we all heard that. And I thought, well, maybe that was something that they couldn't listen to until later, when in fact that playback was available right away.
If
they wanted it.
Well, one of the things that Ron Plush raised after the formal hearing, he submitted another set of questions, was why wasn't the sort of seriousness of this call, why wasn't it amped up when there was another call back from the same number, even though they say they couldn't hear – well, they couldn't hear it.
Well, and there's even some question. The second operator, her CAD screen froze, so it's possible that she didn't know it was the second call from the same phone number because there was some connectivity issues. They were operating out of a backup 911 center.
Right, because there had been a failure.
Yeah. Right, but the servers were still at the main location, and there was a freeze between the two locations, and apparently her computer-aided dispatch screen froze during that process, so she wasn't aware that there had been the earlier call.
She even went to a function for people who can't hear because she's talking back and nobody's talking back to her. And then you can hear Kyle going, "Siri, Siri." He couldn't hear her. She couldn't hear him. I don't want to say this is a complete, total technical failure, but that's really at the heart of this. The heart of this is that system is inadequate, and now it will be fixed. Now it will be upgraded.
There were a couple other reporters pointed this out on Tuesday when this presentation happened. It was interesting. 2 weeks ago, when the initial report came out, the police chief did most of the talking. On Tuesday, the acting city manager presented the entire question and answer report to the Plush family questions, and if there were questions from counsel, there were maybe a couple that were directed specifically at Chief Isaac. Otherwise, during Tuesday's hearing, Patrick Duhaney was the main spokesperson on the issue.
What do you make of that?
I think it was – I'm wondering if they thought that there were enough – when Chief Isaac did the presentation 2 weeks ago, it raised more questions than it answered, and perhaps it was just, okay, that didn't work. Let's let the acting city manager take a crack at it.
I don't know how to read that. I think that last hearing that I went to, they were a little bit on the attack on Elliot. Elliot got a little bristle back, and maybe that's something they were trying to avoid. Why don't you know that, Chief? Why don't you know the answer to that? And he's going, I just don't. So it never didn't go anywhere when it went like that.
Well, out of, and you're talking about not this week's, but a couple
about,
of weeks.
I'm talking about why maybe the procedure changed this week as opposed to the previous week.
But coming out of that session two times ago, the question about Elliot Isaacs was, you know, is he up to the job? I mean, that's literally what some people were asking. So where do you think that stands? Is that question still out there? Is that a fair question?
I didn't get that sense. And I also think, maybe Chris can weigh in on this, but I think the politics on changing the police chief right now would be very bad for the city, especially with the situation then of Harry Black leaving, the police chief before Jeffrey Blackwell leaving. I just think that's I think that would be bad politics all the way around.
I don't know how you could blame this whole thing on Elliot Isaac. There's too many other dirty hands in this. Now, if you're talking about the overtime,
I was going to say, isn't he under investigation for that?
Right, but he's under investigation for that. So, do you want
to? I tend to agree with Jay, though. That's a powder keg right there, because there are many in the African American community who's convinced that get rid of Harry Black, then they're going to get rid of Chief Isaac, and that's a theory that is out there. The mayor has gone out of his way to say that he supports the chief. However, that was before the overtime investigation thing came out. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of interpersonal drama in the police department, as there has been for many, many years.
Jay, where does the status of the interim city manager stand? I haven't heard a word about a search.
The only thing that I have heard way, way off the record is that the mayor was having individual conversations with council members about the process for how to move forward, but that's all I've heard.
Okay. So I would suspect, because we're in the midst of a crisis, several crises.
And that's something that
not going to change.
That some of our colleagues have talked about. Why would anyone want to come to Cincinnati and be city manager? Because number one, you're probably guaranteed that you're only city manager to the end of John Cranley's term, which is, depending on when they get the search done, was probably no more than 3 years. So there's a high likelihood that if it's anybody, it's probably going to be somebody that's already within the city structure.
Okay. But I don't know who that would be. I mean, unless it was Sheila Kilchristian. I mean,
And who's she?
She is the assistant city manager that they just brought back a few weeks ago.
Okay.
Anyway.
So with that, I would like to thank Chris Wederich and Jay Hanselman for joining us today. And Deb Dixon is staying right here with me. And after the break, 44 years of television reporting.
Deb is also the gritty crime reporter with the tough exterior. We can all thank her for bringing Crime Stoppers to the tri-state.
Crime Stoppers is offering a $1,000 reward for any information leading to the indictment of the Mary Carter murder suspect.
In 40 years, it was never as much about the thousands of arrests as it was the peace those arrests could bring the victims and their families. When a man who had served 20 years for rape and murder showed up mowing the lawn in Claremont County, who else had the nerve to walk right up to the suspected serial killer and ask about the other murders? New charges followed for Nolan Ray George.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Who's got enough nerve to sit with Deb Dixon today? I don't know. The best reporters are those who care about their audience, their craft, and especially about the people whose stories they tell. That's what Rob Braun was just telling us about Deb Dixon. For 44 years, Deborah Dixon has been one of WKRC Television's best storytellers. More than that, she was the heart of the newsroom, every colleague's go-to advisor, the person who always knew who needed a hug, and the inventor of Dance Party Friday. Yesterday was Deb's last day at Local 12 in the newsroom. As a master at failing retirement myself, I just couldn't let her relax today. I needed one more interview and one more hug. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org, or we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Deb, Okay. You've already been here, so.
I've always enjoyed working with you, though. I had to come to you for a lot when it came to history and politics.
Well, I was a mere child. I was only there for 36 years, but I started very late. You were there, I don't know, right out of high school? How did you get there? How did you end up in the Channel 12 newsroom?
This is the weirdest story. I was studying to be a social worker at Baldwin Wallace in Cleveland. I came down to Cincinnati and sat in the audience for a live Nick Clooney show. And they let me introduce him. Here you have Nick Clooney. And I thought the excitement and everyone was so creative and the cameras. And I went back to Baldwin Wallace and changed my degree to communications. And then I came back to Cincinnati, was a substitute teacher, and kept applying at TV stations. They hired me as the graphic artist at Channel 12. And then I just worked my way.
Well, your son would be proud of you
as a graphic artist. He's a development director at the Art Academy now. Uh-huh. So I'm excited about that. But then you start to watch the news happen and reporters going out. And I said, I can do that. I can do that better than she can do that. So that's how it started.
Your relationship with Nick Clooney has been amazing over the decades. And it's not just way back at the beginning.
Oh, yes. We still see them all the time. Yes.
And how would you describe that relationship early on in your career? What did it mean? Because we learned to be a reporter from other people.
Absolutely. There's no question. What he taught me, what he gave me, what he made me think about, I still do that every day, and I try to pass it on to some of these kids. He used to say to me, Deborah, you can't do a story until you've walked in someone's shoes. And I think about that. I think about that when I interview people, when I really try to tell their story. You really have to walk in their shoes to tell their story. And he just, I used to go to him and have him read my stories and tell me how I could do a better job. And I'll tell you something else he taught me that I do. And it's just the humanity level, being with him, walking around Cincinnati, and he would treat the doorman, he would treat the homeless guy on the corner the same as he would a senator that he was about to see inside a restaurant. I have always, I think I had that to begin with, but he accelerated it. And I will hug anyone I meet. I don't care if they've been panhandled. You know, it's just the way you treat people is, yeah. I want to treat people the way Nick Clooney treats people.
There was a moment, and I was fortunate to be there during some of that moment, when there was a great sort of core on that front desk. Nick Clooney, Ira Jo Fisher, who's, you know, he's known for writing backwards, but the man was incredibly talented. He's a great writer. And Denny Jansen. I mean, what a moment in time in local broadcasting.
So powerful. And they would, when the three of them would sit there and they would give them time to exchange, people would call and they would say, are those guys going to be on again? They wanted to share that moment with them. They were all so connected to each other and to the community and so smart. Yeah. So, those are good times. But I have to tell you, Rob Braun learned from Nick Clooney, too. And he and I are great friends. Yeah. I mean, every day we go in and talk and we make sure that the day's okay for each of us. So, Nick has left his mark in that newsroom.
Oh, it's very definitely there. One of the things, and Rob mentioned it in that little bit of sound that actually was on Local 12 yesterday about you, but they shared it with us, was you're bringing Crime Stoppers to Cincinnati. How did that occur? And was it just existed someplace else? You heard about it?
It existed in one other city, and it was a little article in Newsweek. And I brought the idea to Myron Leisler, then Chief Myron Leisler. He did not want to have anything to do with that, work that closely with the media. But after about a year and a half, he said, just try it. It's not going to work, but just try it. And police didn't at first trust the tips that were coming in. But eventually, this has failed. Crime Stoppers has failed in other cities, not in Cincinnati. It's one of the strongest in the country. It has to do with a board that raises millions for rewards, the communities that say, not in my backyard. And I brought it here, but this community kept it here.
Yeah, it's institutionalized at this point. That definitely will go on. And
absolutely. It's getting stronger and stronger.
And just where is there a lot of actual identification solving crimes that occurs because of that?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Are you kidding? Yesterday, the man who was arrested for killing the mother and her son in Boone County, that was a Crime Stopper tip. Huh. Someone called Crime Stoppers and said, this guy, her ex-boyfriend, shoots his gun here in this, told him where he shoots his .22. They went up there and got casings and compared it. I wish I had the stats and I don't, but it's startling and impressive how many crimes are solved by people who don't want to give their name. They just get a code number, and then there's a way to pay out. So that they never have to say who they are.
I know there's been so many stories in 44 years, but is there one that you're particularly proud of?
Yes, there is. And it's Joseph Paul Franklin, the serial killer who killed Dante Evans and Daryl Lane on Reading Road in 1980. And I had a relationship meaning we wrote and we talked. He called the station all the time. So eventually it led to—
He was calling you, right?
Yes, calling me because, well, when he was arrested in Florida, I had found out that in Mobile, they called him Jimmy. So when they arrested him, I'm going, Jimmy, and he turns and he talks to me. But the whole point of that was so that someday he would agree to sit with a prosecutor in Hamilton County and confess to those murders. And that's what he did. And he did it because I asked him to. But he also told me, he called and he said, there is a man in prison in West Virginia for two murders I committed. I interviewed him about that. It ended up for that man to get a new trial, and he was freed. And he calls me and writes me, emails me every year. So it was creepy to have to talk to him. He's evil. He's a sociopath. So much darkness, but there's justice for those two boys and justice for Jacob Beard.
Is there a story that you didn't get solved that haunts you?
Carrie Culberson. I know that her boyfriend ex-boyfriend, the one who beat her to death, is serving a life sentence, but her body's never been found. So I think about her. I'm still in touch with her mother, and there will be no peace for her family until her remains are brought home.
Well, Deborah Dixon, I want to thank you for being here today, but also thank you for and congratulate you on an incredible career.
Thank you.
And you're the end of a line because you had a real beat and you pushed that beat for 44 years. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Layla Shakui is our intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.